Welcome to this special edition of the Way Forward Regenerative Conversation Podcast. I'm Jim Burke, the producer. Today, I invite you to listen to Dr. John Izzo's keynote speech launching Elders Action Network's environmental campaign, Take the Pledge, for the month of May 2023. John is a globally renowned best-selling author of 9 books, a professional and dynamic speaker, inspired storyteller, and a highly acknowledged business advisor. In his career, he has spoken to over 1 million people, taught at 3 major universities, and advised over 700 companies on activating social responsibility and purpose worldwide. John is currently an adjunct professor at the University of British Columbia, where he is co-founder of Blueprint, serves on the board of Sustainable Brands, and co-hosts the Way Forward Regenerative Conversations podcast. On Monday, May 1st, 2023, the Elder Action Network launched its one-month-long campaign called Take the Pledge. Our campaign invites elders, their families, friends, and neighbors to pledge to reduce their consumption in 5 major areas: clothing, food, transportation, e-waste, and one other area of their choice. Our overarching purpose is to help people realize that the way we live is directly connected to climate disruption and biodiversity loss. We seek to bring consumer literacy to a wider public and encourage people to replace their current habits with a consumption reduction mentality and regenerative behavior change. We will examine the internal resources we need to effectively awaken our capacities for necessary existential change, how people can build physical, emotional, and psychological resilience in the face of our uncertain future, how the experience of our collective action can build community, be fun, improve our health, add meaning, and even joy, how to become a good ancestor who cares deeply about the future of the planet and our youth for the next 7 generations. You will be able to join the Take the Pledge campaign anytime during the month of May and be able to access all information, resources, and recordings. Please see our show notes for links to EAN, Take the Pledge, and our next pledge events. And now, let me welcome our presentation co-hosts, Dr. John Izzo and Alain Gauthier.
My name is Alain Gauthier. I've been involved in the Elders Action Network for about 4 years. And I'm one of the co-leaders of Elders for Regenerative Living, which is a co-sponsor of the pledge. I am very honored to introduce my colleague and friend, Dr. John Izzo.
So first of all, thank you, Alain, my friend and colleague. Thank you, Pam and EAN, for really giving me the opportunity to be a part of this launch. And thanks to EAN for spearheading this pledge, an opportunity for each one of us to make new choices for a regenerative future. So I'm excited to be here. And of course, most of all, thank you for joining us today, or whether you're listening to this at a later time. The title of my talk today is Being Good Ancestors. And as many of you know, throughout most of human history, ancestors were an important part of the human experience. Until the modern Western era, ancestors were often revered, prayed to, honored, even sought for advice, even though they were long gone. And it seems to me that this focus on ancestors both helped us as humans express our gratitude for those who paved the way for the life that we're living now, for the present generation, but also perhaps a way to recognize a sense of immortality. And the ancient Greeks, for example, not only indigenous peoples, but the ancient Greeks thought that it was through our works that we experienced immortality. So there is this sense that we all know that we owe something to the ancestors, and the life that we're living now is because of them. And of course, we know that's directly true in our own case, since so many of us have been shaped by our own families and their unique histories, both constructive and painful. And we even have a form of ancestor worship in the United States, where the founding fathers, and unfortunately they were all fathers, not mothers, were granted almost saintly status for creating a democracy that has lasted 250 years. Now, some of you may have wished they had been more thoughtful about some of the decisions they made, but likely they had good intentions. I always use the Supreme Court lifetime tenure as an example, where they did that to make it less political. Well, didn't quite work out that way. But the question at this moment is, what does it mean to be a good ancestor in this moment? Another way to think about ancestral behavior is something that Mirella Hernandez at the University of Virginia called stewardship behavior. And by stewardship behavior, she means acting in this moment in the decisions that we make that will influence a future that we won't experience. So one might think of ancestral behavior or stewardship behavior as acting in this moment by the choices we make in a way that will impact even the society, our family, our communities, even when we're gone. You know, as I think about the particular form of ancestry that we're talking about today, which is around environmental sustainability, I think about how I first came to think that it mattered what kind of ancestor I was around the environment. I grew up in New York City, really had almost no experience of being in true nature because our family wasn't very rich and we really couldn't travel to big nature. And I grew up in a mainline Christian family. I like to say God was in the house, and I'm lucky in my case, it wasn't the God of wrath and judgment. I know other people had that kind of experience growing up in a religious home. Mine was the God of compassion and service. And even as a child growing up, while far away from nature, I remember when I did have experiences of nature, I sensed that there was something sacred about it. So my own sense of responsibility around ancestry surely came in part from my religious upbringing and the idea that we were to be servants and to be caretakers. And of course, we can come at that path for many reasons, religious or humanistic. Now, you would not be here today, I don't think, if you didn't think change was needed, if you didn't think that the path that we're on right now is not sustainable. As Alon said, for almost 40 years now, I've been speaking all over the world on purpose and sustainability and regeneration. And one of the questions I ask audiences all over the world is this simple question. I say, how many of you think that if we stay on the path that we're on right now, in terms of the environment, in terms of our relationship to the earth and with the earth, that this will turn out to be good for future generations? And all around the globe, even in audiences of people who are in the resource industry, almost no hand goes up. So one of the good news pieces, I believe, in our time is that I believe most people know it's not working. There is a desire for change. And the question is, how do we act in this moment to be good ancestors? And, you know, when we're thinking about the need for environmental or sustainable change, whenever I'm speaking on that topic, I always like to just choose a headline from the last 24 hours, because I think people always think I'm cherry picking why it's so important that we think about being good ancestors around sustainability and the environment. So as always, I chose one from just about 2 hours ago, headline where scientists were talking about a recent sustainable spike in ocean temperatures that is quite disturbing for a whole lot of reasons on land and on sea, and ended with a rather chilling final quote from a leading scientist who said, "Our fear is the ocean could become a desert." And of course, he didn't mean the ocean would dry up. He meant that the ocean ecosystem might literally be as barren as the desert where I live most of the part of the year in Palm Springs is if we weren't watering it. So first, I want to recognize something really important. I believe almost everyone wants to be a good ancestor, at least in the narrowest sense. I've met very few people who have children or grandchildren who don't care about them having a better life and to thrive in the future. They often make sacrifices financially and otherwise for them. And so I think one of the challenges of our time is to expand the scope of that desire to be good ancestors, not only for our own offspring, for our families or our communities or our friends or our country, but also to connect to the bigger ancestry that all of us are a part of. I always think of this simple example as the family that buys a gas-guzzling large SUV in part to feel their children will be safe in an accident, without ever connecting to the harm that SUV might actually do to the future those children and their own children and grandchildren will wind up living in. So again, I think it's important for us, not those of us who think of ourselves as thinking about ancestry, not to be too critical of those who haven't made that connection. Understand, people have the desire to be good ancestors. I believe the greatest challenge of our time is to expand that. And today is an invitation, of course, for each of you to take the pledge that now I've already taken, which is to, in five key areas, make some simple changes in your life. And that raises an important couple of important questions. I'm sure some of you who have been following issues around the environment and sustainability have days that you're deeply discouraged, where you have maybe sensed that it's too late, that maybe it's too late to do something like the pledge. Maybe it won't matter. And I think of an experience that I had in the mid-1980s with a then colleague of mine, Carolyn Lukensmeyer, who was an OD professional who had gone briefly into politics to be the chief of staff for Governor Dick Celeste, the then Democratic governor of Ohio. And at the time, acid rain was in the headlines all over the world, but especially in North America, because of what it was doing to the ecosystem in the Great Lakes and in lakes north of the border in Canada, where I spend a good deal of my time. And what Carolyn told me is she said, every day, she said, every week, we have people from industry coming into our office saying it's too late to do anything about acid rain. The die is cast. It doesn't matter what we do. It's too late. And I love what Carolyn said to me at the time. She said, those of us who care about the future can't afford to indulge that thought for even one moment. She said, because the moment we indulge that thought, we will stop doing everything we can to make sure that that's not true. Now, I tell that story because while it took 30 years, it's been a long time since you've seen a headline about acid rain in the United States or Canada. And there's a reason for that. Even though the problem isn't completely gone, we've mostly solved it. It's a good news story, and a good news story of ancestry that took thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, individual citizens, companies, government officials, scientists who worked together to be good ancestors. And I believe one of the most important things as a good ancestor is to be aware that we have to have that long perspective. Many of you probably have seen the movie Hotel Rwanda with the General Romeo Dallaire, portrayed by Nick Nolte, who led the UN peacekeepers there, who tried to tell the rest of the world about the genocide in Rwanda and tried to do something about it to no avail. Well, I was recently on the program with that Canadian general, Romeo Dallaire, a few years ago, and someone asked him what I thought was a very powerful question. They asked him, how long do you think it will be before humans don't go to war with each other? Very timely question now, given Ukraine and what's happening in the world. And I loved Romeo Dallaire's answer. He said, it may take 200 years. He said, but we must think that way. And I believe, whether we like it or not, many of the problems you and I care about will not be solved in our lifetime. So we must be motivated by cross-generational thinking, knowing that it may not be solved on our watch. And I think of the Iroquois principle, the seventh generation principle. And the idea was very simple, that the decisions that we make today should be with the perspective of how this will impact the community, the tribe, the future, seven generations in the future. And so I think right now we have to be thinking in seven generation terms. And you might say, well, what is seven generations? It's about 200 years, ironically, because the generation is about 30 years. So if we think in 200 year terms, Romeo Dallaire was probably right. Now, one thing you may well be wondering is, if I take this pledge, if even if thousands or hundreds of thousands of people take a pledge like this, will it actually matter? And it's honestly a reasonable question. So I want to encourage you, to challenge you to say why at least I think it matters. A little over a decade ago now, I wrote a book called Stepping Up. And the subtitle was How Taking Responsibility Changes Everything. I wrote it because I got fascinated with how some people stepped up on an issue that they cared about, or some small group of people stepped up to create change. And I wanted to go out and study case studies, if you will, of people who had stepped up on various issues and created change. And I wanted to understand the anatomy of it, what enabled them to step up and create change. And it's a wonderful book full of inspiring stories, if you'd like to read it sometime. But in writing that book, we did a survey of thousands of people in the United States and Canada, and we asked them this simple question: why don't you step up more to take action on issues that you care about? We thought that was an important question, since we wanted to challenge people to step up. And it turns out, and you might be guessing in your own mind, what was the number one reason why people didn't step up? Maybe they said they were busy. Maybe they said that they had a lot of other things on their mind. But the number one thing, the number one reason people said they didn't step up, is they said, I'm only one person. It won't matter if I step up. And I believe that this is the biggest challenge sometimes in terms of each one of us being good ancestors, is the recognition of this fear we have that what we do won't matter. I think it's no mistake, by the way, that the most prescribed drug in the world right now is for impotence. And I say that because I believe we don't actually have an apathy problem in the world. As I've traveled around the world, I don't think there are many people who are apathetic about the future. But I believe almost everyone feels impotent. They don't really feel that they can make a difference. So I want to tell you two reasons why I think it matters a great deal that you take this pledge, that you reach out to others to take this pledge. And more importantly, that in all the ways we could be good ancestors, we take actions that may seem quite small. Here's the first reason. The first reason is what I call the responsibility ripple. You see, one of the interesting things about change is that each time one person steps up and chooses to make a change, especially if they have the courage to tell others that in a humble way that they're making that change, it changes the status quo. And it's as true in individual relationships. When one person in a relationship that is uncivil decides to be more civil, the status quo changes. When one person in a school decides to stand up to a bully, they challenge other people to stand up to bullying. So every time each one of us acts, we invite others to act. And that's what leads to almost all change. And you can see it throughout history. When Rosa Parks decided to stay at the front of the bus, when asked later why, she said, well, I just happened to be tired that day. And I believe she didn't just mean tired from her work that day, but she was tired of the dehumanization, tired of being a second-class citizen. And in that day, she decided to take a simple action that had a tremendous ripple. Each time we act, we're creating a ripple that becomes the very change that we're trying to create. And I'll give you an example in my book, Stepping Up. My friend Rex Wyler was one of the founders of Greenpeace. And love him or hate him, Greenpeace, especially historically, made a big difference in the world. And Rex is famous for having been one of the people who organized the kind of foolhardy effort to go and confront the Russian whaling fleet in the Pacific Ocean to show the world the tragedy of whales being hunted to extinction for products that we could create synthetically. He even says in retrospect how foolish they were. This is before the age of 24-hour news. There were no helicopters commissioned by CNN following them. They went out literally in a small vessel and in rubber Zodiacs to find the Russian whaling fleet. I'll make a long story short. They found the Russian whaling fleet. took beautiful videos, beautiful in the sense of profound and stirring videos and pictures of their encounter, of harpoons going over their rubber zodiacs, of a beautiful whale dying as she looked, literally in Rex's eyes, almost like she knew they were friend, not foe. Now, that experience did not change the world in terms of whaling, but it created a mind bomb. Those of you old enough to remember Walter Cronkite and his CBS Evening News, that they were the lead story that night on the Walter Cronkite News Hour. All over the world, it created a mind bomb, and it created a ripple. Children in places like Norway and Japan and France and America started writing letters to their leaders. All over the world, people like you and I just started taking action. And some 30 months later at the United Nations, they signed an international agreement to stop the hunting of whales. And while a few countries still hunt whales in the guise of research, for the most part, whales are not now threatened by hunting, but by the climate change and the ocean changes that we are now a part of. But the point of the story is, no one was the hero in that story. While Rex and the group at Greenpeace took the pictures, the rest of the world, through this ripple, is what created the change. And that leads me to the second reason why it matters. And that's something that I call aggregate influence. One of the things I like to say to people is the world can't change because of you. And I can guarantee you one thing. If you start acting more like an ancestor, if you take this pledge and take it as seriously as anyone possibly could, it will not change the world. You cannot change the world. But the interesting thing is the world cannot change without you and without me. And here's what I mean by that. If you look at almost every change that's happened in the world, it really was the aggregate of millions and millions of individuals choosing to act. So that whether it's climate change or plastic in the oceans or all the many issues that we're challenged with today, it will only change because each one of us decides to get in the game, if you will. And one of the beautiful things about this moment in time is we're at a moment where I think the collective consciousness is about to shift. In the podcast that Alon and I have been doing on The Way Forward, where we interview and have conversations with people about a far-ranging set of issues about the future, how do we have to change, if you will, on the way forward. One of the standard questions we have, and I have to hats off to Jim Burke, a beautiful human who happens to be the wonderful producer and maybe brain thrust in our podcast, who I know is on the call today. But one of the interesting things is in each of those podcast interviews, we ask towards the end this question, what gives you hope? And what strikes me is that almost every guest talks about seeing the shift happening, that they see the shift of consciousness, especially among young people, that they see people trying to innovate and take action. And I share that hope. I believe all over the world, we are seeing that shift happening. And the reason it matters if you act and talk about taking action, if you engage in conversations with people who are not acting yet, is that we're all a part of the moment when the herd shifts. I'll tell you a beautiful documentary I saw recently about why herds shift. You know, herds, for example, like zebra. And the scientists thought that there must be a lead zebra. There must be, you know, in a herd, there must be a few animals that everyone kind of looks to. And so when this zebra decides it's time to go to a new watering hole, that's when everyone goes. But through time-lapse photography, they found out that it's actually much more beautiful, maybe almost spiritual. It turns out that what actually happens is a few zebras start to get a little nervous. They start to get edgy and look towards another place that they might move. And then a few more do it, and a few more do it, until finally, almost all at once, the herd simply moves. And I believe that's exactly what's happening now in humanity. By taking this simple pledge, by inviting others to do it, that we are aggregately helping to shift the very thing that we want to happen. And I believe we are close to that moment, and it will take a lot of innovation technologically and a lot of courage for us to make it. But I'll go back to where I began. We cannot afford for a moment to think it's too late. Like the people said to Carolyn Lukensmeyer and Governor Celeste in Ohio about acid rain. Some people told the Rex Weiler and the folks at Greenpeace, it's too late. The whales are almost extinct already. We cannot ever afford to do that or to believe that our actions don't matter. And you may wonder, how can I get others who aren't as interested in this to make a difference, to engage as I do? And I want to go back to someone I mentioned earlier, a woman named Morella Hernandez at the University of Virginia, who's been studying for a number of years now this thing she calls stewardship behavior, and I might call it ancestral behavior, meaning why do some people choose to act now in the interest of future generations, even though the benefits of that, if you will not impact them, nor the challenges. And one of the most fascinating things that she found is that philanthropy, the desire to do good, is not actually the strongest motivation for people to act with stewardship or ancestral behavior. It turns out the most powerful motivator for most people is legacy. It is wondering, what will I be known for? What will my legacy be? And I believe, I'll come back to the personal. I believe when most of us are acting for our own children and our grandchildren, we're hoping one day our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren will be looking at pictures of us, and people will be talking about what great ancestors we were as mothers, as fathers, as uncles, as aunts, as friends, as people who were generous and generative. When I work with CEOs, which I do a great deal, I have found that my most powerful way to engage them around sustainability and doing good is to ask them this simple question. 10 or 20 years after you are gone from this position, what do you want your legacy to be? And what's fascinating is when I ask them that question, they never say to me, we were profitable, we grew our market share. Instead, they talk about the kind of things we would hope they would, the legacy, the positive legacy they left behind for all the stakeholders, including the communities they were a part of. So let me close to open up for questions with a few more things. Carl Sagan, I was a fan of Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan, as you know, was probably the only popular astronomer, except for perhaps a Stephen Hawking, who's a more physicist than an astronomer. But Carl Sagan was probably the only popular astronomer of his time. And when he died too early of brain cancer, in a couple of years before he died, an interviewer asked him this question: was he optimistic about the future of the human experiment? And I loved his answer. He said, if this was, by the way, in the mid-1990s, they asked him if he said, if you were able to project me out 50 years, which would be now, you know, somewhere around 2040, let's say. He said, if you could project me out 50 years and we had neither blown ourselves up nor destroyed the environment beyond repair, he said, I'm very hopeful about the future of the human experiment. He said, because I believe that all the trends are in the right direction. But he said, but we're in this critical window for humanity where we must get through these next 50 years. And you think now maybe we only got 20. And so it matters even more than ever that we're good ancestors, because while every generation probably thinks this is the most important moment, I believe that Carl Sagan is right. We have the chance, the danger of doing either of those things in the next several decades, but we also have an opportunity to choose to be good ancestors. So I challenge you to take the pledge. I challenge you to take it seriously as I plan to. I challenge you to invite at least five other people. That's right, five other people to take the pledge, whether they say yes or no. And I challenge you to tell others your experience of taking the pledge. Now, before I open up for questions, I want to close with a story about a small way I think I was a part of being a good ancestor, another positive experience. I grew up in Staten Island, New York, one of the five boroughs of New York City. It was the greenest borough at the time of the five boroughs, the least populated, and we still had a lot of green space and forests that had remained. But there was one section of the island called the Greenbelt, much of which had been protected in parks, but significant amount of it that was unprotected. And at the time, developers were intending and had plans to literally eat away at the Greenbelt and destroy this one protected belt that still remained on Staten Island. I was in high school at the time, and I joined groups of people who started protesting the way we did in the 1960s and the early 70s, and some still do today with signs and writing letters, etc. I have to tell you, I was a very small part of that story because I left Staten Island and went to university in 1975 when I graduated high school. But others kept trying to be good ancestors. Just a few years ago, I was flying over Staten Island as I was landing in New York, and I looked down at Staten Island, and guess what I saw? An almost perfect circle of green. That green belt, all those 30 plus years later, people had been good ancestors, and it still remained. Now, sadly, there are other battles that we have lost. And as my friend Rex Weiler, one of the founders of Greenpeace, says, the unfortunate thing is the bad guys only have to win once. We have to win every time. So thank you for listening today. Let's be good ancestors. And Alon, let's open it up for comments and questions. And again, thank you. Let's engage together now.
Thank you very much, John. Beautiful. I also want to mention that Pam Nichols is with us, who is the initiator and designer and the project manager of the Taking the Pledge. And thank you, Pam, from your work on being a good ancestor. Do you have ideas for how we can be effective in reaching out to others to invite them to take the pledge or take other sustainable action?
I meant what I said. One simple personal challenge to each one of us, and I'll make the public commitment right now. Alon can hold me accountable since he'll see me, to communicate with five other people, asking them to take that pledge. That's the first thing that we can do. And I always feel like if we want to invite others to take something, we need to do it in a humble way, not a preachy way. You know, I was a Presbyterian minister in my first career. So even when I was preaching, I tried to be invitational rather than confrontational. And so I think rather than saying, look how high and mighty I am, you need to take the pledge, just say, here's why I took it. Here's why I felt I wanted to take that action. And so making it personal is really important. I think one other thing is I want to go back to Alon, something I said, and thanks for the question, is that I believe even people we disagree with, even people we think are not taking action on some of the issues that maybe those of us today in this virtual room think are important, the 90%+ of them care about being good ancestors for their families, for their children, and likely for their friends and local communities. But I believe they may not make the connection, back to my SUV example, to the way in which my broader actions may be impacting future generations in a way I may not be thinking. So again, I think the best thing is to talk about that for yourself. And that will invite others to, I think about that themselves. So here's how I might do that. I might say, you know, I really feel a responsibility for my grandchildren, just as an example, you know, to help them get an education and opportunities. But I've also been thinking that what kind of a world are they going to be in 20 or 30 years when they have children or grandchildren? And I think a part of my responsibility is to think about that as well. That's one reason I'm taking the pledge. So helping people make the connection between being a good ancestor and not just these actions that might impact my own immediate clan, if you will, I think is really important. And because in the United States in particular, the left-right divide is so strong, I think one of the tragedies of our time is that the environment got wrapped into the left-right divide. Many of you who know history may know that it was the Republicans who led the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act as much or more than the Democrats. It was Republican governors like Nelson Rockefeller, you know, in New York, who did some of the earliest environmental decisions by governors. So Republicans used to be actually pretty pro-environment, even though they were also pro-business. But now, because the left-right divide has grown, almost every issue, you got to be on one side or the other. And sadly, the environment got wrapped into that. And I think when we're speaking with people who are of maybe if you're on the left and you're speaking to people on the right, I think that that's a good thing to mention, to say, you know, I know we disagree on a lot of issues, but I suspect we don't disagree on leaving a healthy planet for future generations. And so I think we have to, individually, we can help untangle that thread. It won't be easy, but I think that's one of the great challenges in the United States in particular, is how the environment has gotten wrapped into the left-right divide in a way it probably shouldn't have. Anyway, that's right enough on that.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Another one. Thank you for your inspiring talk. I work with a group who includes two wonderful people who are adamant that we are doomed. All we can do is to provide a gracious ending for all the others. How do the rest of us work around this? It is so frustrating, but I understand where they are coming from.
Well, you know, I've had the privilege a couple of times to spend a little bit of time with Al Gore. And Al Gore says something really interesting, because whenever he is asked, you know, are you pessimistic about the future? You know, are you kind of, in essence, are you gloom and doom? His answer is always the same. He said, it isn't practical. He said, it's not really useful for me to lean into doom and gloom. It just means I'll stop acting. It just means I'll lose heart. So the first thing I would say to people, it's not really practical to embrace doom and gloom. The second thing is, I think we need to remind people of the progress that we have made. If you ever want to feel better about the world, Steven Pinker from Harvard, wrote a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature a number of years ago. And basically what he said is, everyone says things are worse than they've ever been, but in fact, they're better than they've ever been. So he goes and says, we kill each other less, there's less, you know, wars, there are fewer people as a percentage of humanity in poverty. He goes through, on almost every metric, things are actually better than they've ever been. The acid rain story is a great example. So the ozone layer. So I think we need to remind people that humanity, race relations, and sure, we have so much progress still to make in the world around diversity and inclusion and around gender and race, but who could argue that we haven't made tremendous progress in many quarters, certainly in our societies here in North America? We're there yet? No. But I think we have to point to people to the progress we've made. And I would tell them the Romeo Dallaire story from Hotel Rwanda fame. You know, they said it might take 200 years, but we have to think that way. And sure, do I believe that humanity is likely to experience a great pain in the next 20 or 30 years from climate change? Yes. Do I personally believe that the species is going to go extinct? No. The earth, as my friend Rex said, I'm not worried for the earth. The earth has dealt with bigger things than us. It's us we should be worrying about. So I think you have to tell them why you have hope. Remind them of the progress we've made, and remind them that it's not helpful. And quote Al Gore if you have to. You know, he knows as much about this stuff as anybody. And he says, look, gloom and doom is not a practical choice. We need to choose hope, because hope is what will keep us in the game. And that's the best we can do, by the way. We can't take it on from others, but we have to challenge it in, again, a humble, and tell them why you have hope. Because again, the more we just speak from our own hearts, the more we're likely to invite change rather than confront for change.
Beautiful. Thank you, John. Question. We are asking individuals to take the pledge. How do we ask corporations and businesses to take the pledge?
First, as someone who works with businesses, I can say that there's no doubt this is on the mind of almost every meaningfully sized enterprise than it has been in certainly my lifetime of 40 years of working. There's a higher level of consciousness, a higher level of desire. There is a tremendous amount of greenwashing and surface commitment. Don't get me wrong, but the pendulum is shifting. So I think Jim's question, the important part is, how can we help accelerate that? So I'll give you a few things. First of all, one pledge you can add to this pledge, if you want to add one for yourself, is to start actively supporting companies that are really doing good things around sustainability and actively punishing those who aren't. And there's a variety of ways we can punish and reward. We can reward with their business. We can reward by, in social media, speaking highly of those companies and highlighting what they're doing. And the opposite is also true. And I personally believe we're better off feeding those who are doing good than we are fighting those who are doing bad, because I think that member responsibility ripple also works in business. When one competitor takes action, they're more likely to attract talent. They're more like, because young people especially are very motivated by this. And secondarily, that they will then have a better image and goodwill out there. And I'll just give you one simple example. TELUS, a big telecommunications company in Canada, has been a client of mine for years. A lot of their business is in Alberta, an oil-producing province in Canada. And they took a rather bold stand on climate change a couple of years ago and got crucified in Alberta in particular in social media. People saying, I'm not going to do business with you anymore, screw you, et cetera. What struck me was how few TELUS customers, except for a few like myself, took to social media to defend them. And I imagine what might have happened if people had said, no, wait a minute, I don't agree. You know, great on them to do that. So we have to also help defend those companies. And, you know, Alan, I have to also say I missed something really important today. I meant to also talk about the unique role that elders can play in this conversation. I just want to say one thing. Go to my TED Talk sometime on the boomer generation. Just look up Dr. John Izzo, TEDx, you know, or TED, and you'll find me. But one of the things that is so important to understand is in the developed world, we will be the largest, most highly educated, wealthiest, and longest lived group of elders in human history. So as a percentage of population, we will be in the developed world the largest number has ever been of older people still alive in human history, and wealthier, will live longer and have more lives, you know, opportunity to make a difference. And I just ask you, dedicate your encore career. Don't worry about money to this. Use your influence and don't, you know, join hands with younger people. I think older people especially often feel impotent, like, well, it's younger people's time. And in my TED Talk, I referenced a survey where they asked young people, who's most responsible to fix the future? They said, we are. Yeah. They asked older people like us, who's most responsible to fix the future? We said, they are. And I don't buy it. We're as responsible as they are. And we happen to have more time on our hands, more money than they do, more political influence. And we're going to live longer than any generation in human history. So us being in the game around ancestors matters. And besides, this is the time of life you're supposed to be thinking about your legacy anyway. It's the good time to be a good ancestor. So anyway, I apologize, Pam, but I got it in now. In my notes, but I had too much to say.
Thank you for adding that. There's another question. What about people who are in fear or grief around the climate, especially children? Yeah. What would help them?
It's a good question. I know, speaking personally, because I have such a, even as a child, I was one of those child, I grew up in a neighborhood in the 1950s and early 60s, a neighborhood of all boys for whatever reason. And, you know, boys can be a bit, well, boys. And I remember some of my young friends would pour hot water into ant colonies. And even as a young boy, I remember just like my heart breaking for those ants, even as a young child, should have told me something about myself. But when I read about some of these things that are happening to species and also to humans around the world, I'm often brought to tears. I have a tender heart, so I understand this grief. And grief has both a positive and a negative opportunity. You know, there's a line in the book of Ecclesiastes in the Jewish scriptures that says, it is better to go to a funeral than a party. Now, it doesn't say is it more fun to go to one. It doesn't say you should go every day. It's better to go to a funeral or a party because grief will teach you something about the tenuous nature of life, its shortness, the need for us to act now. So grief can be positive, but it also can be debilitating. Any of you who have experienced personal grief know that. So what I want to just say is, I think we have to allow people to grieve, and then we have to say it's hard. I know it's so hard not to stay hopeful, but I think we have to, again, talk to them about how we have hope, but we have to listen. We have to acknowledge that grief. Just like when we lose someone in our lives, we have to just say, I don't know what it's like if it hasn't happened to me, or I know what it's like a little bit because it's happened to me. But then not say, get better, get over it. So listen deeply, but then slowly and tenderly to offer them the opportunity to do something about their grief, which is to do what they can to continue to live into their life. So it's not an easy question, but grief can be debilitating. It also can be motivating. So I think we have to honor it, listen to it, and maybe speak about how we deal with our own grieving and are able still to. So when I cry for that species that's gone extinct or that dolphin colony that's been herded into a lagoon and killed, I try to channel that grief to change because that's what I can do. And that's at least how I do it.
Thank you, John. There's one more question that I see. There is an important climate response known as deep adaptation. And actually, Jem Bendel published a book around that, as you know. What is John Easel's response to this response? I myself support the approach to hope, his approach to hope, along with Rebecca Solnit. But should we take seriously deep adaptation?
Yes, we have to. And I think whether we like it or not, I've taken many pledges over the years that I've kept, but we will need technological innovation and we will need adaptation. It is too late because of the interconnected reinforcing cycles that are happening. Simple example, as the ice melts in the Arctic, it reflects less sunlight out into space instead of absorbed by the earth warms. So I could go through many of these, right? So because the nature of these reinforcing cycles in the earth, which is an organism, it's an organism, really not a, you know, static thing. It's too late for us not to have to adapt. So we have to have deep adaptation. And at the same time, we can't, I think, just lean on that. But whether we like it or not, individual action will not be enough. We will have to adapt. We will need technological change. And we can't be afraid of technology or adaptation. Yet it can't be an excuse for simply doing what we've been doing, spiritually and practically. So I think it has to be a part of our conversation. And, you know, to saw the comment that came there, you know, I've been saying, you know, my first book was a book called Awakening Corporate Soul. And I've believed for many years that we really have a spiritual problem more than a technological problem, that it is our basic relationship with each other and with the rest of life that is a part of this. Our belief that we are apart from nature, not a part of nature. Our belief in separation rather than oneness. And so I believe that in that sense, deep adaptation is also required. We need a spiritual awakening. So while people may recognize the need for change, you know, there's another in Al Gore's, you know, original movie. One of the things he said, I remember one of my more powerful scenes to me is his wheeling his luggage through, I think, an airport in Singapore. And he said, as I travel around the world, I keep looking for signs that we've made the kind of, I don't know the words he used, but made that deep shift. And he said, I don't see it yet. And I still feel that. While at the surface, I think we're starting to get it, I do think we need an even deeper awakening. I hope that will come, though in the meantime, we have to act whether it comes or not, though that would really make a difference if we could get there. And as I said at the beginning, what drove me to care about sustainability? My deep religious beliefs as a young person that this was sacred and that I had a responsibility to caretake what was sacred, right? And I believe if in one way or another, through humanism, through collectivism, through intellectual pursuit, through philosophy, through religion, if we came to this sense of the sacred and our connection to all of it as sacred, that would make a huge difference.
Beautiful, John. And I want to mention one of the programs of the regenerative elder process. We are putting a lot of emphasis on looking at alternative worldviews like the indigenous or kinship worldview, where we are all one with nature particularly. So thank you for highlighting this.
On our podcast, you'll see lots of conversation about that, among many other things, around a different worldview that perhaps we need to reconnect to.
Thank you. I think we'll wrap it up now and ask Robert Whitehair whether you'd like to say a few words.
It was very thoughtful and very encouraging. I appreciate so much all your life stories and what you've done. I learned a lot, and thank you. One of the things you mentioned was the fact that a lot of this is personal action, and you have an opportunity to take personal action, because sometime in the next few years, this is mundane, but your water heater is going to go out. And why replace gas with gas? So come to our seminar next Friday at 1 o'clock, and you can learn all about it. We can show you the process. So thank you, John. Spectacular.
Thank you, Robert. Pam, would you like to say a few words at the end?
Well, thank you, John. Thank you, Alain. Thank you for everyone who's attended. It was really a wonderful way to start the energy around the campaign, which starts next week. I hope those of you who are asking what the pledge is saw the link to the website. And it's about taking action on as good ancestors for a month, for the month of May. So take a look at the website and you'll get all the information you need.
John, we have one more minute. Do you have any parting comments that you'd like to make? You've shared.
Yeah, I do. And thanks for all those wonderful comments in the chat. You know, when it comes to change, we ought to think about a fascinating research on getting people to get out and vote. It turns out that there's two ways you can try to get people to get out to vote. One is to send out messages. People are apathetic. They're not voting. We need to get in the game. People are not voting. The other message is people in record numbers are choosing to vote, to have their voice be heard, join the crowd. You might take a guess in your own mind, what is the research said is more likely to get people to get out and vote? And it turns out the latter by far. And here's why. Because when you normalize for people that you're a part of the herd, you're a part of the herd that's not acting, why step up? You know, other people aren't stepping up. It turns out when you tell people the herd is moving, the zebras are moving, don't be left out, be a part of it, people are more likely to want to be a part of it. So I think it's a lesson for those of us in the environmental and sustainability movement who tend to focus on people are apathetic, they're not, you know, let's talk about we're taking action. Record numbers of people are taking the pledge, getting in the game, voting, join the herd. I think it's fascinating research that informs a lot of how I try to approach my work.
I want to thank you for taking the time to listen to our podcast, The Way Forward Regenerative Conversations. You have many choices, and we appreciate your interest and support. You can reach us at our email address, thewayforwardrc@gmail.com. I would also like to thank our sponsors, Elders Action Network and Blueprint NGO. Elders Action Network is building a movement of elders to address the environmental, governance, and social issues of our time. Their website is eldersaction.org. Blueprint is catalyzing a global conversation about the state and impact of men in the world. Together, they are mobilizing men to be a force for good. Their website is blueprint.ngo. Until next time, I'm Jim Burke, and this was the Way Forward Regenerative Conversation Podcast, which you can listen to on Podbean and Apple Podcasts.